Hello, I'm Jane Crowther and welcome to the subscriber version of Inside Total Film. And as always, we're so chuffed to have you on board. Thank you so much for taking out a subscription. Today, I'm joined by our contributing editors, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. And Neil Smith.
Hello.
Hello. This week, we're chatting to Pablo Larraín about Spencer, and we'll be reviewing that as well as Eternals, The Card Counter, Bull, and Red Notice. That's a lot to get through, isn't it, chaps? So shall we get started with the biggest of those films in terms of budget and scale? But is it the biggest in terms of star ratings? It's this.
We're Eternals. We came here 7,000 years ago to protect humans from the deviants.
Why didn't you guys help fight Thanos? Or any war, or all the other terrible things throughout history?
We were instructed not to interfere in any human conflicts unless deviants are involved.
By who?
So this is Eternals, not The Eternals, Eternals. I have to get this right, don't I, James? What's it about?
Well, first of all, it's based on the 1970s. Well, they first appeared in Marvel Comics in 1976. Jack Kirby, who's a very famous Marvel supremo, he brought them into existence. And when we join them, it's 5 years on from the blip in Avengers Infinity War. So we're sort of in that period of the MCU. The Eternals are the sort of oldest superheroes in existence. They were sort of sent to Earth by these sort of cosmic beings, the Celestials, to guard us against the Deviants, who are this sort of carnivorous race of alien creatures. And they've done that pretty effectively over time. Now they're sort of scattered across the globe. But when a deviant pops up in London, in Camden Town, no less, Cersei, who played by Gemma Chan, who is one of the Eternals, who are, I should add, sort of immortal. So they've been sticking around for quite a while, 7,000 years.
Yeah, she's looking good on it.
She's looking pretty good. Cersei pretty much hangs out with Sprite, played by Leah McHugh, but the rest of the Eternals she hasn't seen for quite some time. Then Icarus, played by Richard Madden, who has got these kind of cosmic ray-like powers, the sort of beams that shoot out of his eyes like Superman. He pops up to help them deal with this deviant in Camden Town, and they decide they need to sort of reunite the rest of the gang to fight off these alien hordes. And I think that's where we could leave it, where it goes on from there.
Yes, and this is obviously directed by Chloe Zhao, so a very different director. She hasn't done anything like this before. Does it work?
Eternals is always going to be a divisive proposition. I mean, it's a whole new cast. It's a whole new mythology. It's sort of a side mythology to what we've seen in the existing MCU, tangential to it, but not really connected. So in many ways, it's almost like a kind of new Justice League coming in. The styling is more DC, really.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people are going to kind of have issues with it, the size of the cast, the kind of where it goes. But I think I'm going to be the Eternals optimist here. I rather like it. I like the scale. I like the ambition of it. The 7,000 years time frame is certainly grander and more epic than what we've seen before. And I think one thing that Chloe Zhao does bring to it is that she does consider Earth is more than just a collection of superheroes. I mean, one of the issues with the MCU I have is that all the characters are either superheroes existing or superheroes in waiting who just haven't become superheroes yet. Mm-hmm. At least Chloe Zhao considers Earth in all its kind of magnificence, all its population, and it tries to sort of put these Eternals in context. I know some people aren't going to like it, but I rather did.
James, did you?
I wasn't as big a fan as Neil. I was a huge fan of The Rider and Nomadland, of course, Chloe's last two films, Nomadland, of course, winning 3 Oscars this year. So I guess I was always on to be slightly set up to be disappointed. Neil makes some really good points that the cast is huge, and it's pretty difficult to introduce 10 new kind of heroes into this world and give them all their moment on screen. And I think to some degree she does manage that. They all do feel kind of organically introduced. I like what Neil said about the way Chloe kind of considers the world. I mean, this story sort of bounces from when we start in Camden Town, but then we sort of bounce to, well, not only flashbacks to sort of Aztec and Babylonian and Mesopotamian times, but all over the globe. Also Iran, the Amazon, Australian outback at one point. And it looks fantastic. You know, it looks absolutely beautiful. So there's lots to enjoy about it. But it's she was on an extreme on what I'd call a hiding to nothing as a task here to introduce all those characters and set them up and find an interesting story to tell is very, very difficult. And I didn't think she quite pulled it off for me.
Yeah. And for me as well, the thing is that with that many characters to introduce, there are naturally going to be those that are more entertaining than others. And for me, most of them were really stiff and stagey. And, you know, there was only sort of a couple of them that actually lifted it. And the script felt very sort of biblical. And I say that not in an epic way, but in a sort of, and then we shall do this, and here be the being. And we all talk very, very portentously. And I just thought it was dull, beautiful, but dull. So for me, the only standouts were sort of Brian Tyree's Henry and his sort of little quips, and Kumail, he was good. But, you know, this sort of hangs on Gemma Chan's shoulders, really, doesn't it? I mean, to all intents and purposes, I feel like she's the lead, although the lead does swap about as we go along, no spoilers. And I didn't think she was given enough to do, really. And also, how much crying? You say everyone gets their moment. Everybody gets a moment to have a little sob and a beautiful tear go down their beautiful face. It's the most lachrymose film I think I've seen in ages. I didn't get it. What about, though? I mean, the thing with this is where it stands within the MCU and where it will take the MCU. We do have two post-credit stings. Obviously, we're not going to talk about them in detail, but did they thrill you?
Ironically, in that I mentioned how there is a human character, but towards the end, we find out there may be more to him that we haven't necessarily seen. But so that one is an intriguing angle that where that could take the franchise. The other post-credit sting is a little bit of a damp squib in that regard. You're not particularly interested to see where that one, in which direction that's going to take the franchise. But like you say, it's a bit of an outlier. And maybe that's why I kind of liked it, in the fact that it all the other movies kind of hold into each other. And it does, like I say, set up a whole kind of mythology, a whole kind of tangent for the MCU to go in if it wishes to go to. Obviously, it would depend on how successful it is and whether the audience takes these characters. And I think some of these characters are going to come back and some of them won't. It's bold and it's ambitious, and I don't think it should be kind of taken down a peg for that. Yeah, let's have more Oscar-winning directors into the MCU and see what they do with it.
You have to look at the way James Gunn brought in Guardians of the Galaxy, which is I wouldn't say that in any way the same, but there's five sort of new characters there. So that was a brand new group that no one really knew particularly. And he brought it in with such sort of irreverent humor, and that they were so enjoyable to watch, even on their first outing where you didn't really know who they were. And these characters, possibly with the exception, as you mentioned, of Kumail, who's sort of playing Kingo, who sort of disguised himself as a Bollywood star. And that was a really lovely
and
segment
his valet,
in the film.
His valet.
And the valet. The valet is the best character in it, basically. But that humour was really welcome, but I didn't feel there was enough of that. But maybe that's just not what they were going for. And like Neil says, there's so many new directions this can go in now. We've almost might have to suffer our way through this film to set up for what's to come, because I think it could be really interesting whatever direction it goes in.
Yes, indeed. And we also should mention that Lauren Ridloff obviously is signing throughout this. So there's that is lovely to see sort of that inclusivity on screen. There is a gay character in this. There's people from all races and nationalities in it, different accents going on. So yeah, I see what you're saying, Neil, about that sort of global approach to it, that it's not just white men in America doing stuff with technology. It's about people having feelings all around the globe. So that is appealing, and that is nice to see our world sort of more accurately reflected by the MCU. So would we recommend people go and see this? Obviously, dismaying post-credit sting number one aside, which I hated. Would you say go see this?
I would recommend it. I do feel that there is enough in the movie to warrant a look, and I think people will see more in it than they might be expecting.
Mm-hmm. James?
Yeah, if only to see Camden Town smashed up, it's well worth it for that sequence alone.
Okay, so Eternals is out in cinemas on Friday. Go and check it out. Okay, so Christmas is incoming, isn't it? The clocks have gone back. It's time. So shall we go to Sandringham with this?
Diana, they can't change. You have to change.
You have to be able to do things you hate.
You hate?
There has to be two of you. There's the real one and the one they take pictures of. Diana, for the good of the country.
For the country.
This is Spencer, which is an imagining of what 3 days at Sandringham during Christmas might have been like for Princess Diana during the height of her bulimia and the unhappiness of her marriage. Before we discuss this one, let's hear what director Pablo Larraín had to say about this project when he chatted to Matt Matem earlier this week.
Pablo, thanks very much for joining us today. Whereabouts in the world are you at the moment?
I'm at home. I live in Santiago in Chile, in South America. Oh, cool. That's where I am.
So to begin with, sort of on that note, really, Diana is such a famous figure in the UK, especially. So how well known is she in Chile?
Well, I think she's a global figure, probably one of the most famous and beloved person for sure from the 20th century. And I think her figure and legacy remains alive. I grew up seeing my mother being really interested on her figure and her fashion and the way that she was wearing her hair. And I always wonder why. And then I grew up and I realized it was just not my mom. It was like pretty much everyone in the world. So there was, you know, such an interesting material for a movie, I believe.
Mm. And so had you kind of thought about her much as a character before the sort of film came in your direction? Or was it something that only really you kind of put a lot more thought into once this kind of project came your way?
You know, I actually had the idea of doing this movie. Mm. And then we invited everyone that finally made the movie. But I thought that there was a chance to do something very specific in just a few days of her life. And then fabulous writer Steve Knight came in with a concept and he wrote it. But there was always the chance to make a movie that would speak about her identity as a person, as a mother, and as someone who had a very strong and interesting and beautiful life apart from the royal family. And that's why the movie is called Spencer, is how she recovers her name and her identity.
Did you always have in mind to set it over kind of such a short period of time and in a sort of, you know, such a specific single location, really?
Yeah, that was my proposition to, my initial proposition to our writer, to Steve Knight. I had done a movie called Jackie that also it's just a few days of her life. And it's interesting to do that because what happens is that when you have someone going through a big deal of a crisis, you could probably get to know that person really, really well. Any of us would be very exposed to who we really are when we are going through, you know, a very specific and strong crisis. And that's why we decided to focus on just a few days.
The title card at the beginning of the film describes it as a fable from a true tragedy. Can you kind of explain a bit how that sort of defines your approach to this kind of, you know, interpretation of Diana's life?
Well, that's Steve Knight's idea. And I think it represents really well what we're doing because we did talk about a fable in the process, but the way he wrote it and put it like that, it really makes sense, I think, because it is a fable and it is a short story and it is the tip of the iceberg, as they say, right? You are able to see just a little bit and just with those elements, you can expand it in your own imagination, depending on your biography, your background, your interest. And of course, we didn't want to get into the tragedy itself, but since we all know what happens after the story takes place, you don't really need to get in there. You just have to let it breathe.
Mm. So kind of how similar or different was it to the way you approached Jackie Kennedy's life in the film Jackie you mentioned earlier?
It was different. It was a movie that I was invited to make, but I had the script already written.
Mm.
We did work on the script and shape it a little bit, but it was somehow cooked, and I thought that that inviting Natalie Portman to do it was a good idea, maybe the only possible way to actually make the movie. I never saw another actress. But it was a similar process. It was, you know, it's a very contained movie in terms of the period of time that it covers. And it's a very intense and unlike Spencer, I think Jackie's about, you know, it's about grief and memory and legacy. And I think Spencer is about motherhood and identity. So yeah, I remember it's just a beautiful process. And what's related in between Jackie and Spencer is that it's about both women were key people in the 20th century that were related to very powerful families. And they were married to very strong and powerful men. And they were, in both cases, struggling to find their own identity. And they both did. And they both were able to conduct their life in a way that it was very surprising, very unique. And a way that people felt empathy all around the world, I think.
And so for Spencer, when you and Stephen Knight were sort of pulling it all together, was there a lot of research you could draw upon for like life at Sandringham and things like that and that time in Diana's life? Or was there just kind of a lot of imagination going into it?
When you want to avoid certain things that actually happen, or you want to change certain things and turn into more of a fiction, what you want to do is to know as much as possible how things really are. So we did extensive research, but what is interesting is that once the doors are closed, the only tool that you have is fiction, and that is what we can earn to work, but that's what we do.
And there's some really sort of fascinating sort of customs we see in the film, such as the guests being weighed on arrival and the sort of just the intense formality of choosing the clothes to wear, you know, to the different meals and things like that. Were those things based on research, or are they sort of educated guesses?
No,
about
that's
what goes
they're both. But what you're mentioning is that's based on research, but that's real. But there are other things that we don't know, you know, but we do know that there are a number of rules based on tradition. A number of things are based on protocols, right? And things that they have to go through. That nowadays, if we, you know, compare it to most people's life in the contemporary world, they can seem even, you know, absurd, you know, the amount of rules and power that they have to deal with. So, yeah, I thought some of them were fascinating, and her fashion is relevant because she was such an icon, you know, a pop icon, whether it's related to fashion. And I think that's very beautiful and interesting.
And so how did you come to cast Kristen Stewart as Diana? What qualities did she have that made her right for this?
It's hard to describe because it's really something that works in a very internal level, I think. But I will say that I saw her work in Olivier Assayas movies. And I felt that she had something very internal and mysterious. She was right at the age. And she's a wonderful actress. You know, I keep thinking that she's like the actress that we had in the 50s and 60s. You know?
When you're casting a role like this based on a real person, are the hair and the makeup and the costume tests and the accent and things like that, are they all part of that sort of casting process? Or do you just go with the sort of actor, like you said, you kind of trust from kind of seeing performances in other films and just kind of trust that all of that other stuff will kind of fall into place if you've got the right actor to build it around?
Well, it's the only way to do it. I mean, you can't talk to an actress and then, you know, have her in a process that would take a number of months to get to a point to decide that person can do it or not. You have to take the risk and you have to, you know, say, okay, let's do it. I just felt that she was right because she has a very strong internal world that I really, really appreciate and connect with. And then all the physicality and the technicality of the way she looks and the way she works, it's work and process. I never thought that she was going to nail the accent so quickly, right after the first couple of sessions that she had with her dialect coach. She quickly got it really well, and I was very surprised. Not because I didn't think that she was going to do it, because it was just so quickly, and it was just great. And once those things are settled, you can really focus on making the movie and deal with what's essentially, which is the filming itself and creating the film.
Do you see Spencer as a horror film in any way?
I think it's a movie that has different tones and styles and genres. And I think at some point, the movie goes into a dark place where a huge psychological crisis is going through. And you could say that probably there's some elements of psychological terror in it. Mm. Yeah. But just, you know, in some moments of the film, pretty much in the middle, in the center part, I think that the movie has a very clear and simple structure that it's about starts with a crisis, then becomes a very internal sort of psychological terror crisis, and then there's a healing time as well.
I felt like I saw elements of The Shining sort of present in there, and I've seen other critics sort of draw that parallel too. Was that something intentional from you, an intentional homage? Or?
It's very interesting. I was talking to Guy Hendricks about that, our production designer, because the thing is that such an iconoclast and a visionary filmmaker like Stanley Kubrick, of course, would influence many, many ideas and concepts. And I'm a big, big fan of his work, and I've been very influenced all over my life. And maybe there are things on about, you know, that you could relate to that movie. But the movie that we really saw and looked at was Barry Lyndon. That was the movie that we really saw and looked at. And then I'm reading on the press that it looks like the Overlook Hotel. And I'm like, okay, sure, whatever. But the truth is that maybe that movie is already inside of us. Mm. When you make a movie inside of a house that it's cold and somehow empty. So I understand it was more Barry Lyndon in terms of other things. But you don't know. it's great what happens, you know, that people start seeing other things that we didn't see.
Perhaps this tied it to The Shining in a way for me, but the kitchen and the kitchen staff and sort of particularly Sean Harris's character are kind of a really fascinating part of this film. Can you talk a bit about how that kind of became an important part of the story?
For two reasons. I think one, it's because it's related to a friendship that she had with the chef, right? Mm. So it was a door to connect with Sean's character. There's also an interesting way to see how the protocols are and how, you know, not only the luxury, but how systematic the food can be, you know, in terms of how it's worked and how the idea of pleasure, it's combined with protocols and tradition. And then also I'd say that it's a good metaphor and friction with the eating disorders that we know she had. So having a movie that where there's so much food in it was an interesting element of friction and crisis that could be in the screen, especially knowing and thinking what Diana went through in certain moments of her life.
Okay, so that is Pablo chatting to Matt. Neil, where are we seeing Princess Diana here?
It is roughly 10 years into her marriage to Prince Charles. And we say roughly because the year is not defined. This is not a kind of the crown depiction of royalty. It's like an imagined weekend with Diana arriving out of the blue into this very cold and forbidding royal residence, where she's already managed to alienate herself by sort of thinking for herself and going against the grain. She has allies in the house. The chef Darren, played by Sean Harris, is on her side. She also has a very loyal maid, played by Sally Hawkins. But generally, it's her against the establishment. And the establishment is represented by Timothy Spall as this very stern-faced, hatchet-faced major who rules the house with a rod of iron. In the course of this weekend, you see her come to the point where things come to a head in terms of her relationship to with Charles, played by Jack Farthing, her relationship with the royal family, and her relationship within this establishment in which she's entered far more naively about a decade previously.
Mm. So this is the director who did Jackie, as he discussed with Matt, which was, you know, loved and not so loved in equal measure. I think people sort of didn't warm to it, but also really loved it. Does this work for you in the same way with Diana? I mean, we have had quite a few Diana projects, including the musical, lest we forget. How does this one work for you, Neil?
All the talk has been about Kristen Stewart's performance as Diana, and she's already emerging as a front runner for the in the awards season. And it's a really terrific performance. She gets Diana's look and the voice, and she gets some of the personality, and she's utterly riveting to watch. I just wish it was in a better film. I think that the film itself has issues. And the biggest issue for me is this rather cartoony depiction of the royal family, who are these sort of terrifying gargoyles. Half of them don't even speak, and they kind of they stare menacingly at Diana from across a sort of empty ballroom. And there's no real sense of them as anything more than this rather sort of evil block of people wishing to kind of crush her spirit and individuality. There are scenes that are charming. There's a scene which I found a little twee, but I think some people will like of her playing with the young William and Harry. Sally Hawkins is great. It's a little underused, but I think she's great as the Diana's chief ally. But I feel as if it was ironic that you had Kristen Stewart going so much to get like Diana in perfect detail when the world itself seems so kind of fantastical and unreal.
Well, I am not a huge fan of Pablo's sort of earlier work. Jackie, I didn't really connect to. And films like No and Neruda, again, I just found emotionally quite distant. But this I did actually quite enjoy. I was quite surprised. I definitely accept what Neil says. The depiction of the royal family is quite strange. I mean, the Queen has a couple of lines and again, has this gargoyle-like effect that Neil mentioned. It really, I mean, it's very similar to Jackie in that it's trying to get inside her mind, inside her point of view. And I think it does that very successfully. I was really taken with Kristen Stewart's performance. There were moments when I was looking at the screen, looking at her, knowing it was her, and yet she just melted into Diana in that moment. And I was like, I know, of course, it's partly the wig and the sort of look that they've given her, but also the way she held herself. I just thought it was a fantastic performance. There are some strange elements that I had reservations about. One thing we haven't mentioned is she's given this book about one of Henry VIII's wives, Anne Boleyn, and she begins to sort of see Anne Boleyn's ghost and see her as some sort of kindred spirit. That didn't work for me at all, basically. So that element I didn't enjoy. I really did love the way the upstairs, downstairs kind of depiction of the sort of the worker bees sort of keeping the royal family fed and watered over Christmas. I mean, Neil mentioned Sean Harris, who's great as the chef, and it's almost treated like this kind of military operation to bring this obscene amount of food to them on Christmas Day. There were elements that I really, really loved. It didn't entirely work for me, but I did find the scenes with William and Harry actually quite tender. I thought they worked, and that is ultimately the point of the film. Is she kind of reclaims her identity as a kind of mother more than anything else. And no spoilers in terms of what happens, but that very much plays out in the last couple of scenes. There is, I should add, a fantastic use of Mike and the Mechanics at the end.
Yep.
Truly hoping that will be playing out at the end of this podcast, but you know, I don't want to influence it in any way. But yeah, so I really did enjoy it more than I thought I was going to.
Same. I didn't love Jackie. It wasn't one of my favorites. And I think one of the things was that glacial aspect to it, and this is equally very glacial, isn't it? But I thought that worked for Sandringham, this very cold house with full of very cold people, nobody who has any empathy for anybody, it seems. You know, it's been likened to sort of The Shining, hasn't it? A Kubrickian sort of feel to it, this huge empty house full of cold kitchens with walk-in fridges full of puddings, which I enjoyed personally. Obviously, Diana did not. In terms of setting a scene and evoking a place, it really worked. And as you say, you know, hats off to Kristen Stewart. I absolutely think she's going to get the Oscar and all of the awards going this season, because not only is it a wonderful portrayal and actually probably the best portrayal of Diana I've seen in terms of it felt like it really got to her soul in a way, but also just what a step up for Stewart. She's always been a sort of quite fidgety actress that when you see her in roles, you can always see Kristen Stewart in the role, doesn't matter what she's playing. And, you know, I find that very charming because I think she is very charming and I love what she does. But this was, as you say, I forgot it was her entirely. No lip biting, no sort of playing with her hair or her rings that she usually sort of incorporates. No Bella Swan. Bella Swan is long gone from this role. And so I just think for her as a personal achievement and for the film, she should be recognised. But yeah, there were things that didn't work, you know, eating pearls in soup, ghosts. some odd choices about scarecrows and coats that I just felt were a bit on the nose. A very strange shooting scene that was odd. And like, yeah, I think we get it. And I suppose the other thing about Diana is we all know so much about her and so much about her life and so much about what went on behind closed doors. There is not going to be anything surprising in this. So don't expect to have your view of Diana changed, I guess. But in terms of really empathizing with her, I think it really did the job. Did you see the Kubrickian similarities, you guys?
I have to say I didn't particularly. Although now you mention it, I have seen that sort of mentioned on social media and sort of thinking about it. Yes, it probably makes sense. I'm hoping someone will now make a documentary with people obsessed by the references to The Shining inside Spencer or something, which may well happen. I guess so. It's not something that really struck me, though.
Okay, so that is Spencer, which is out in cinemas this Friday. Let's move on to Plain Talking, where we demystify phrases said on film sets. This one this week is Martini Shot. James, what's the Martini Shot? Let's hope it involves Martini.
Well, I should hope so. It is the last shot of any given day on a shoot. That's just the nickname it's been given. So after that, you can all down tools and go and shake yourself a martini, shaken, not stirred, obviously.
Yes. It's not to be confused with the Abby Singer shot, which is the penultimate shot, which was named after an assistant director, Abby Singer, because he was very efficient, apparently. And so you knew you were nearly done when he was calling the penultimate shot. Anyway, so that is the martini shot. Shall we move on then to our next film of the week? It's time to hit the tables with this.
Having been sentenced to 10 years in prison, I learned to count cards.
How'd you do that?
Poker's all about waiting.
Check, raise, re-raise, call.
Then something happens.
You remember him?
This is where all the good stuff happens.
They made you the fall guy.
You need to back off.
You've been around him. He's a mystery. And I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
So this is The Card Counter. James, tell us about this one.
So this is written and directed by Paul Schrader, who many years ago wrote Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and Last Temptation of Christ, all for Martin Scorsese, and has since gone on to make some amazing films himself, most recently First Reformed, which got him his first ever Oscar nomination, unbelievably. Yeah. As the title would suggest, this might be a sort of casino-related gambler story. Oscar Isaac plays William Tell, who is a card counter. He spends his time in casinos, in sort of low-level casinos. He doesn't really bet big. He doesn't want to draw attention to himself. Really, he's in some sort of purgatory, you could argue. And he's just come out of prison on a 9-year stretch. And I'm not sure how much we should say about why he's been in prison, really. We should probably leave that.
I think best to find that out yourself.
Yeah, I agree. While in these casinos, he encounters a couple of people. Lalinda, played by Tiffany Haddish, who sort of has been watching him and wants to sort of encourage him to bet bigger and to sort of take him onto the casino circuit, the sort of professional gambler circuit, let's say. And then he also meets a young man called Kirk, played by Ty Sheridan. Kirk's father has a connection to William Tell's past. And it kind of goes on from there. But without wanting to reveal too much, I think we should leave it at that point.
Did you like it? I mean, Taxi Driver is quite a high bar.
It's centered, like Taxi Driver, on a quiet and sort of brooding anti-hero who's living this rather monastic existence on the fringes of society, having this relationship with the cards, which is purely mathematical and theoretical, so that he can kind of just focus on that. And maybe that is a way in which he can avoid the demons that are sort of haunting him at night. It's anchored by this terrific performance by Oscar Isaac, who, let's just give a shout out to him. What a year he's having.
I know, right?
Dune, he's had Scenes of a Marriage with Jessica Chastain. He was even in The Addams Family too, if you want to bring that up as well. But he's had this...
Let's not forget the thirsting online for him. I mean, he's become a sex symbol this year too.
But this performance, I think, is the best thing he's done this year. And in fact, possibly since he started. I mean, it's incredibly kind of cool, magnetic, simmering kind of performance. You can't take your eyes off him. The way he kind of steers us through this world of poker and blackjack, the maths and the calculus that go into what he does, the way he goes back to his motel room at night and kind of methodically wraps every piece of furniture in these white sheets to turning
it
into it. Yeah, turning every room he's in into this sort of cell of the mind. It's a terrific performance that kind of just proves utterly compelling. But also, I'll give a shout out to Tiffany Haddish too, in what is probably her first kind of dramatic role, although there are elements of humour to it. I think she makes a really interesting foil. In this story, which you want to find out, what's making this man tick, what's making this man seethe, what's kind of keeping him on this centered existence that he doesn't want to let other people in, and what happens when he does.
I didn't think Tiffany Haddish worked that well, I have to say. It didn't work for me. I felt like she was uneasy trying to do drama. Although I liked the chemistry between them, I thought she was actually the weakest link. What did you think, James?
Yeah, well, her element of the story, I suppose, provides some sort of redemption for Oscar's character. And yeah, I wasn't fully convinced, not necessarily by her performance, but by that particular element of the storyline. I mean, the big focus is really the relationship between Oscar's character and Ty Sheridan's character, and they a sort of almost surrogate father-son experience as we kind of go through. Again, it's a story about guilt, I suppose, and as I mentioned earlier, sort of he's in this sort of purgatory for what he's done in the past. Schrader's a massive fan of, to be pretentious for a moment, Robert Bresson, the French director. Yes. Diary of a Country Priest is a big one for him. He's repeatedly referring to that in Taxi Driver and does here as well, as Neil said, that sort of monastic-like existence. Again, I mean, if you think of American Gigolo, another Schrader movie, or Light Sleeper with Willem Dafoe, who a regular for Schrader who pops up here as well, he often centers on these kind of men in crisis kind of stories. And again, this is another one that fits perfectly well in that sort of oeuvre. And that worked for me really well. I mean, we can't really talk about it, but there's an incredible fisheye lens shot. Let's just call it in a flashback sequence. One of the most incredible shots I've seen this year. Can't really explain what it's about because it would give too much away.
It's an awful section. It's awe-inspiring and also awful. I think it's really interesting as well to position somebody in a sort of purgatory because of his past in a casino, you know, a place where no time exists. There's no windows. You don't know what the weather's doing. And people are just sort of like drudges at tables, just gambling any time of the day and night. That really sort of worked for me, that idea of this man on a sort of treadmill and wearing the same clothes, doing the same thing every day, going back to the room, as you said, Neil, and creating this strange cell. And that the only escape from that comes in Tiffany's character. And there's a sequence where there's lights, I will say, no more, but there is light in this film that comes into this darkness in a sort of quite sort of mesmerizing way. Just felt like a real 70s film, didn't it? Like some of the sound was a little ropey. It felt like it could have been made in the 70s. It didn't feel modern and slick. It felt weirdly timeless. So I really like that. And yeah, as you say, Oscar is an absolute cracker. So we're recommending this one, I reckon, highly, because we're all into this one, right?
Very much so.
So that is The Card Counter, which is out in cinemas on Friday. So shall we move on from one man with darkness in his soul to another?
You Marco's boy?
Yeah.
Go home and tell your dad Bull's here.
No, Adam says he's seen Bull.
No, it ain't Bull. Bull's gone.
If you don't tell me what happened to Aiden, I'm gonna make you eat that little knife you're holding.
I'm coming for all of them.
So this is Bull. James, who's Bull and what is he up to?
Well, Bull is played by Neil Maskell. This is another film, a bit like The Card Counter. I don't want to talk too much about for a synopsis to not give things away. Bull is a, let's call him an enforcer type character for a sort of low-level crime family or crime organization. somewhere outside of London. It's not particularly clear. Essex, maybe?
I was thinking Essex. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll go with Essex. And Bull, much to everyone's surprise, suddenly comes back on the scene. No one's quite sure why, and they're all scared because he's out for blood. Primarily, he's looking for his young son, Aidan. That's the motivation for his journey. But to borrow from Paul Thomas Anderson, there will be blood in this film.
It's incredibly violent, isn't it? But it doesn't feel like it's unnecessarily violent. These are very violent people. This film really shows this group of people. You wouldn't want to meet any of them in a dark alley, would you? Neil, did you enjoy it, even though there was blood?
I found it very compelling. It sits into a certain tradition of British crime movie, of Get Carter, of the implacable man on a mission with vengeance in his heart and a couple of weapons in his pockets. It's centred on Neil Maskell, who I think is brilliant at presenting this almost kind of emotionless, vigilante kind of obsession as he cuts a swathe through this crime family of various denizens. It's a film about mood, and a lot of that mood is quite oppressive, and it is a very oppressive watch. You're locked in this story with these rather unpleasant people, and you really just want to get out of it. But that's a kind of testament to the filmmaking rather than more than anything else. But the performances are on that register of people who are locked against each other in this rather hellish journey into the darkness of their souls.
I mean, this is really about the sins of the father, isn't it? It's very much, you know, if you live and die by the sword is essentially the theme here. Nobody is nice. Should you care about any of them, James? Or is this literally an exercise in tension? And I mean, it is as ruthlessly efficient in its running time as it is its main character, isn't it?
Yeah, it's 87 minutes and it's absolutely lean as a piece of work. In terms of care about the characters, well, I think that the relationship between Bull and his son is quite tenderly portrayed. And I think that's what you're meant to care about, that this is why he's on this journey. Yeah, I think Neil's sort of spot on. The rest of the characters are sort of pitched at this kind of one note level of aggression. We should mention David Heyman, who plays Norm, who's the kind of leader of this group. At one point we see them all wearing kind of high vis jackets, so it seems like they're some sort of highway maintenance. That would seem to be their kind of cover
their
story,
let's
call them.
Yeah.
That might be their day job. I'm too scared to go near any highway maintenance people from now on if they're like this. But yeah, I did find there was an emotional through line, you know, to care about Bull's journey through this. But it is absolutely brutal at some points. I mean, we should add it's by written and directed by Paul Andrew Williams, who a few years ago he made London to Brighton. This is probably the closest thing he's done to that in tone, although they are very different films. Since then, he's been on quite an interesting journey, different types of films, and he's done a lot of television work recently. This feels like the best film for me that he's done since London to Brighton. Yeah, it's just completely fat-free as a piece of work. You're in and you're out. And I came out very satisfied, I have to say.
I loved it. I thought it was blistering. Just so economic with what it did and how Maskell performs it. It sort of reminds me of The Craze, not the Kemp's version of it, but that idea of this everyday violence and people living with everyday violence, and that everybody is susceptible to this, even an 88-year-old old lady having a cup of tea in her house. And the matter of factness that violence is dispensed, you know, if you don't tell me this, love, I'm just going to have to cut you. It sort of reminded me in the same way with its that tenseness, but also that depiction of Calm with Horses, that everybody might get their comeuppance, and really everybody does deserve to, so nobody's safe. There's also Tamsin Outhwaite, who we've not seen for a while, being very unglamorous here, and I really enjoyed watching her. And yeah, a fairground again. I find South Coast fairgrounds sinister at the best of times, but again, I wouldn't want to go on the waltzes anytime soon with a mild looking chap in an anorak, because bad stuff happens. I thought this was amazing. This is my film of this week. If you want to go to the cinema and support smaller budget films that are doing things brilliantly, this would be one to go and see. You guys?
Yeah, I really like the way it, also the way it kind of parceled out bits of the story, you know, nothing too rushed. You found out in a very sort of satisfying way exactly the reason these characters being thrown together again. It's a week of really kind of sort of compelling performances in very different types of film. Yeah, I mean, you know, goodness me, I mean, a film that that tells such a satisfying story and doesn't need 3 hours to do it. Mm-hmm. More of those, please.
Yeah, very much so. And Neil Maskell, I know we touched on him already, but my God, he can scowl and swear like the best of them, basically. There's that moment in the car where he's sort of got these two kids in the back and he's got one of Norm's sort of minions next to him. And he sort of, he turns to this guy who's driving and goes, just do it. Yeah. It's absolutely spot on. It quite reminds me of Terrence Stamp in The Limey when he kind of goes, tell him I'm coming. There are little touches. There's a sort of meat factory scene at one point, which reminded me of The Long Good Friday. Yeah. It's just whether those are intentional or not, I don't know. But as Neil said, it comes out of this sort of tradition of sort of British crime movies and does so really well.
Yeah, I mean, you'll never think about the Three Little Pigs story again in quite the same way, will you? After Neil Maskell has told two children that in the most menacing fashion. So this is Bull, and this is available in cinemas on Friday. Go and see it.
And actually, if I can add, I'm doing a Q&A at the Hackney Picture House with Paul Andrew Williams on Friday at 6:30. Come down, check it out, and hear a bit more about how the film is made.
Yes, do so. Very nice, James. I will come and see you because I'm just around the corner. Lovely. Okay. So finally, should we move on to our last film, which is, you know, what do you get if you put Deadpool, Black Adam and Wonder Woman in a film together? It's this.
I want you to help me catch the most wanted art thief in the world, the Bishop.
Hello, boys. It's so nice to finally meet you in person.
She set me up, framed me.
A few clever keystrokes and bye-bye, Adrian John Hartley.
She's gonna steal Cleopatra's eggs. They're priceless.
If we catch her together, I can clear my name.
And I'll help you become the number one thief in the world again.
Lift with your neck. Even if I did partner up with you, you'd still only have one brain.
What's your plan, son of a...
So this is Red Notice, Netflix's latest big budget, big starring thingy. Neil, tell us about it.
Well, you've got Dwayne The Rock Johnson as John Hartley, an FBI agent who's traveling around the world in search of the world's second most successful art thief, played by Ryan Reynolds. His name is Nolan Booth. And the idea is that if Dwayne can bring Nolan on the side, they can together team up and they can get the world's best art thief into custody, played by Gal Gadot as a character called the Bishop. So basically, if they can combine their forces, they can bash the Bishop.
Any good? I mean, for me, this was the weakest film, actually, and I thought it would be Eternals this week. But yeah, I mean, I think it lost me as soon as I saw the aviation gin placement in the film and then followed by Dwayne's tequila placement. This is very much feels like, you know, powerful multimedia, multi-hyphates going together to sort of do something that they get money for and promote their products. I don't know. I didn't really know what it was for. It's kind of fun, and it nods incessantly and knowingly and snarkily to other films, doesn't it? But is it working for you as a film on its own?
They knew what they wanted. They wanted The Rock, Ryan Reynolds and Gal Gadot in the same film. They didn't really care about the quality of the film because they just knew that that is a very attractive proposition to Netflix's international legion of subscribers. You get The Rock. He's tough, he's laconic, he takes a place to fight scenes. You get the Ryan Reynolds you're expecting. He's a motor mouth full of wisecracks and sort of off-color remarks. And you get a very kind of a sexy, slinky Gal Gadot. You get lots of locations. You get stunts. You get car chases. You get everything you would expect in from a sort of sub-James Bond Mission Impossible clone, really. What you don't get is any spark of originality. You don't get much chemistry. And the actual MacGuffin, when I tell you it's about Cleopatra's eggs, you may think we may be entering into the world of in vitro fertilization. But no, we're actually talking about these three clunky, big, golden Easter eggs. And the reason why they're being so sought after is the most silly, ludicrous stupid reason. Doesn't even bear repeating. I mean, you know, people will discover it for themselves and be face-palming for the rest of the evening. There's no sense of originality. There's not much kind of spark to it. It just goes through the motions, and it's almost like they designed the poster and then they came up with the film.
Yes, James, felt the same?
Absolutely. It was utterly tedious. I've saw this film, I don't know, 12 hours ago, and I still can't remember. I can't remember anything about it now, virtually. I mean, thank you for the reminder, Neil. I tried to block it out of my head. There's also one of the worst star cameos towards the, I won't reveal who it is, towards the end of the film that I've probably ever seen. That deserves a Golden Raspberry Award, I think, on its own. Everything Neil said is spot on. It was just tedious. I find Ryan Reynolds quite difficult to like when he's in this snarky mode. I enjoy Dwayne Johnson generally as an action hero. I think he's really good, and he's fine in this, but it's just a really poor script. And as you said earlier, Jane, it just references other films, but not in, you know, doesn't do it as well, basically, in any capacity. I mean, how many locations does it go to? I mean, Cairo is one, Valencia. Did they actually go to any of those locations?
Well, this is what I was going to say. It felt very much like they did it in some sort of green screen room and they were positioned in locations, because we got these beautiful shots of locations around the world. They were always in sets. You didn't feel like you actually went anywhere. It felt very inauthentic. Not that these films are really trying for reality. Even that didn't feel like it was gelling. And yeah, Ryan Reynolds here, I love him in Free Guy. You know, I think he's great as Deadpool, but this for me is the Bodyguard's wife end of his output, which I can't stand. The Rock is absolutely fine, because really totally dependable for entertainment, the old Rock. And this is something I'd watch on a plane if I'd had a glass of wine and a warm pasta item in a small tray. I'd probably be quite happy with this, because I don't really want to think about anything when I'm flying. I just want to watch something that entertains me in a sort of very beige fashion. And that's probably the level that this is on for me. But also the other thing, can I just ask? This is a film where people drink gin neat, and they also did it in the card counter. Lalinda ordered a Hendrix on ice neat. Is drinking gin neat a thing? Is that a thing now?
No, I'm a gin and tonic man all the way.
Ryan Reynolds comes into his house. He's got his bottle of like room temperature gin there. He pours himself a glass of it, doesn't even pop an ice cube in, and he's like, delicious. And he's in Bali. Why would that be nice? A room temperature gin in Bali. Wouldn't you want something more refreshing? Anyway, that's the level of thinking that I was going into whilst watching this film.
We should mention the fact that they do go to the trouble of defining what Red Notice is, which is apparently the highest level of Interpol manhunt that they're looking for. It's not even the worst movie I've seen this year with Red Notice in the title. There was a Sky movie called SAS Red Notice that was pretty
terrible.
Which
Jordan Farley starred in. He was an extra. You'll see him go.
That film is way, way better than this Red Notice. I mean, I'm not saying it's brilliant, but that was way better than this one.
I mean, it's ironic when a Red Notice kind of deserves a Red Notice or a red card or something of that nature. It just didn't seem to me as if they really even wanted to make a film. They had all the elements and they thought they would just throw them together and people will watch. The gap between sort of, you know, concept and product, they didn't give any thought to the execution.
But it's a little bit like that Six Underground that Ryan Reynolds was also in for Netflix, and Chris Hemsworth's Extraction, that they're perfectly decent to watch on a streaming service, but nothing more really.
You mentioned the sort of globe-trotting aspect of it. You know, it feels as if it's ticking a box. You know, we go to this location, that'll appear to that demographic, and we go to here and we'll do this. We'll add this element. The sporting cast has a faintly international feel to it, which also seems targeted to certain demographics. Yeah, it's a box-ticking exercise, no more.
Yeah, and a very unconvincing CGI bull involved as well.
Our second bull of the week, in fact.
Yes,
but definitely
one of them is more convincing than the other. Yes, indeed. Okay, so that is Red Notice, which is actually available in cinemas this Friday before it streams on Netflix from the 12th of November. Personally, I think I'd save that for Netflix when you're having a bottle of wine, wouldn't you?
Netflix and chill. Yeah, or maybe just Netflix and chill out and just switch off.
There's got to be better things on Netflix than that, I'm sure.
Okay, thank you, The Rock. We await Black Adam with more enthusiasm, I think. So it's time to go then. But before we do have time for a reader's question. And it's bonfire night this week in the UK. So what's the best movie involving fire?
I went for Barton Fink by the Coen brothers, where there's a sort of hellish landscape towards the end where this hotel that the Barton Fink character sort of resides in goes up in flames. That's one of my favourite fire films.
I'm going to go for Bambi, the fire at the end, the forest going up in flames and the animals kind of fleeing in terror. It terrified me as a kid, and I think it's one of the best fires on film.
And it is terrifying in life as well, with the wildfires and stuff. It's like the concept of it is horrific. Very good choice. I mean, I have to give a little nod to Backdraft, because when that came out, if you remember, people were like, whoa, we've never seen fire like this before. And that whole thing of like, if you open a door and it sucks the air, do you remember that whole sequence? It sucks the air and then it explodes and then a fireman goes flying across the room. I have to give a nod to that. But actually, I think my favourite film involving fire is Rebecca, the original, the Hitchcock, with Mandalay going up in flames with all that matters in it and creating a purge, a new start for Mr. and Mrs. De Winter. Love that film. So that is all we have time for. It's time for us to say goodbye. We should also say Bull has a fire in it that's quite terrifying too. But shall we say goodbye for now? Say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Neil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. Bye.